G'day and welcome. I am Mordechai Becher.
And I'm Yoshua Karsh.
And welcome to the Two Rabbis in the podcast. And our last session, we spoke about music, and that is really only part one of music in Judaism, because we do plan on having some guests, a guest, maybe more than one guest, who are experts on music and Jewish music specifically, and we will interview them, and that will be part two of our presentation on music. A second announcement is that we hope to have an Israel update every podcast, and the Israel update will be given by my son, Pini, who lives in Israel. He is a lawyer. He was just called up for his third round of reserve duty, 60 days. Don't know where he's serving at the moment, but hopefully he'll be able to carve out some time from reserve duty. He says usually the first few days is pretty chaotic, but then they settle into some type of routine, in which case hopefully we'll be able to have him on to update us from really deep inside Israel about
We'll get a lot of secret stuff that we'll be able to promote.
Yeah, I don't know about, but okay, well, we'll
a
see.
Lot of it.
We can ask him, but you know, that may get censored. The Mossad may close us down.
Which is very good publicity, by the way.
Definitely. Yeah, excellent. Yeah.
Not that we need publicity. I'm not saying we need it. I'm just saying.
It would be it nice.
Would.
Yeah. I did meet one Mossad agent, retired, Peter Malkin, who was responsible, one of the team who captured Adolf Eichmann.
Seriously?
Yes. Yeah, he was the guy who actually grabbed him off the sidewalk and threw him in the car.
How did you meet him?
He was retired, and he came to speak at twice, actually, at Shabbatonim conventions with Gateways I used to work for, and he spoke and participated in the program. So it was great to meet him. And a tremendous privilege, real hero, and fascinating man. Maybe we'll have a chance. We can talk about that more.
Did you find out that any of your secrets had then been revealed after you met him?
Well, when I met him, he was already retired. He was working primarily as an.
He could say he's retired. He worked for the Mossad. How difficult is that for a Mossad agent to say he's retired, even though he's not retired?
He might have been
the target.
He was in his 70s.
You're saying that there's a retirement age for spies? Is that
my guess is, yeah, I'm imagining so.
You could have been the target. Did you ever think of that?
No, never crossed my mind.
All right. Whatever.
Okay. So anyway, this week's episode is all about literalism. We were going to talk primarily about, do I have to take Midrashim, Medrash, and Agadata, homiletical components, non-legal parts of the Talmud, Midrash Rabbah, Tanchuma, etc. Do I have to take those literally? And Rabbi Karsh decided that we should maybe extend that even to discussing how literally do we have to take the Torah itself? And that's actually a great point. And to some people will sit there aghast at even asking that question. But the first thing you have to know is that there are parts of the Torah that is prohibited by Jewish law. Jewish law feels that it's wrong to take parts of the Torah literally. Which parts of the Torah can you not take literally? And you should not take literally. And according to Maimonides, it's actually heretical to do so. Answer, descriptions of God.
Tzelem Elokim.
Exactly. When we are told in the Torah that God took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, that does not mean like a big arm from heaven coming out. That's not what it means. What does it mean? Good question. Commentaries discuss that. But to take that literally is actually wrong, because that is attributing human characteristics to God, anthropomorphism. So that which is done, that you can do, attributing human characteristics to God can be done, but with the caveat that it's not really a description of God.
Now, there's a Rashi that is sometimes quoted with regard to this, where it's where, and there's a group called the Corporealists.
Yes.
And I've read, I even remember I had this conversation one time with Aviva Zorberg. I was trying to understand what they mean. But look, they say Yad of Mamash, because Rashi says Yad of Mamash.
Yeah, they're a fringe group. Yeah. It's a fringe group. They are, as in the immortal words of Dennis Prager in a different context, they are as representative of Judaism as the snake-handling sects of Arkansas represent traditional Christianity.
So that's, okay, fine.
Okay, so I don't know if we have to deal with them. I mean,
then we will not.
Mainstream Jewish
thought. I don't want to touch any buttons.
Okay. Maimonides and others understand that the Torah itself will utilize expressions that it understands should not be taken literally, like corporeality when attributed to God. And there's a Mishnah and the Talmud in Tractate Tamid, which discusses exaggerations in the Torah. For example, it says that that the Mishnah says that there was a pile of the ashes and the oil left over on the altar, which was up to 300 kor. I don't know exactly how much of that is in kilo, but huge, like let's say 300 kilo, 300 liters, on the, which is a massive ball of ashes. And
because ashes, sir, they don't weigh a lot.
The what?
They don't weigh a lot.
They have oil and grease in them. So
that's true. That's true.
So, but I did switch from kilo to liters.
Okay.
So it's a volume measure. But in any case, Rava in the Talmud straight up says, Guzma. This is an exaggeration. What it means is a huge pile of ashes, very large, but 300 is an exaggeration. Another example, it says that they used to water the offering with soak it with containers of gold. Rava says no, that's an exaggeration. And Rav Ami comes along and says, he says the Torah sometimes, even the Torah itself, sometimes exaggerated. The prophets, the language used is Dibru Belashon Havai, which I don't know, I guess the best translation would be exaggeration, because that's the examples of bringing. So for example, the Torah tells us that the cities of the Canaanites, this is in Deuteronomy 1, the cities of the Canaanites were fortified unto the heavens. So there, the Talmud says that doesn't mean they had 30,000 foot walls. It's an exaggeration. It means they had very, very high walls. Another example from the books of the prophets, it says that at the coronation of King David, I think it was, they had trumpets and flutes, and the sound of the orchestra was so great that the earth split as a result of the sound. The Talmud says, Havai, it's an exaggeration. So you have numerous examples of this, sometimes exaggerations. That Rashi actually quotes that Gemara. Rashi, on the spot where the Torah says that the walls of the Canaanites were fortified to the heavens, Rashi himself quotes that piece of Talmud and says, Dibru Belashon Havai, it's an exaggeration. So we see that there are certainly places where we should not take it literally. So obviously this raises a question of where do you draw the line?
Yes.
Where do you draw the line? And which is a great question. So we were just discussing Rav Saadia Gaon, and the Rambam, Maimonides after him, says almost the same idea. Could be he got it from there. But Rav Saadia Gaon in his book, Ha'emunot Va'Deot, the book of beliefs and knowledge, he says this, that generally the default position with Torah is literal, except in four cases. So my default position when I'm reading the Torah is I'm taking it literally. But there may be four reasons that will persuade me not to. One, your senses tell you it is not so. What do you mean by senses? The example he gives is that Chava, Adam and Eve in Hebrew, Chava, right? Chava is related to the word chai, life. So I remember we had a friend of my parents who moved to Israel. Her name was Eva. And after moving to Israel, so I was at their house, and I said, are you going to call yourself Chava now that you're in Israel? She says, Mordechai, I don't want to be walking around known as the mother of all flesh. So I'm staying with Eva. I said, fine. Okay, Eva. So that's fair enough. But the word Chava means Ein Kol Chai, the mother of all living things. The mother of all living things. So Rav Sajigon says, really? Horses? Elephants? Crocodiles? No. It means all humans. So it's not literal. It means by all life means all human life. So it's
this would be the sense of sight. I mean, because he says senses.
He does say senses. So I'm not sure what he means by that. But in other words, it's blatantly contrary. Obviously, no animal is born of a human being. So it can't mean literally.
And we know he.
All life.
The Torah itself says Hashem brought the animals to Adam to name them. So, and the Torah says the animals were created before Adam.
There you go. So right. It's not possible. It's just not possible. Just from reading the text, it's not possible to take it literally.
But yet, he doesn't say that's the reason why it's impossible. He says it's because we just see it.
Yeah.
Is how I'm interpreting it.
Yeah, that's what he does say that. Yeah, he doesn't bring that as evidence, but yeah, that's type of interesting. Why not? His second reasoning is shehaseichel doche oto. One's intellect, one's rational faculty refuses to accept it. So his example of that is God is described as ki Hashem Elokecha eish ochlahu. The Lord your God is a consuming fire. So he points out that he says, you know, fire is a physical effect. It's combustion. He says the intellect cannot accept that God is a combustion reaction. That just doesn't make sense. And so what does it mean? He says his vengeance is like a consuming fire. There are other commentaries who say that just like a fire, depending on the fuel you put in, will change the color of the flames and the intensity. So your perception of God and your prophecy depends on what you put into it and the intensity and the color. It's like an interesting perspective. So either way, describing God as a consuming fire clearly is not meant to be literal.
It's poetry.
Correct. Ah, and what you mentioned earlier was that, as we discussed last episode, the Torah is described as poetry, and hence some of these things could be used that way.
Hashira Hazos.
Exactly. The third reason, he says, if there is Mikra Mufurash Hasotro, there is another verse that contradicts the verse that you're looking at. So if there's two verses in contradiction, we could say, and maybe we should say, that one of them is literal, one of them is not. So I don't know, maybe an example of that would be where the Torah tells us that on the 10th day of the seventh month, you shall fast, afflict your soul. And then it says in a different verse, from the ninth in the evening till evening, you shall afflict your soul. Now we know that in the Jewish calendar, the ninth, let's say Yom Kippur is on Thursday. All right. So the ninth would be Wednesday, which means if it says from the evening of the ninth, you shall fast, that would be from literally from Wednesday, Tuesday night, till Thursday. So the Talmud says that's not, but on the other hand, it says on the 10th. So there's two ways the Talmud resolves that. One is that what it doesn't mean literally the entire ninth, but it means add from the ninth onto the 10th. From here, we derive a very famous law that you always have to have a little buffer zone before and after every Yom Tov, every Shabbat, add a little bit before, add a little Tosefet, the addition, which is actually a positive commandment. The other is that if you eat heartily on the ninth, you are fulfilling it, the mitzvah, as though you fasted both days. Either way, it's not taking the ninth in the evening in a literal fashion. There's a contradiction. And number four, kol ma she'ne'emar lanu b'mesoret she'yesh bo t'nai. If we have a tradition, Moses transmitting from Sinai, an oral tradition down through the generations, that would be something where if we have a tradition that the author, God, told Moses, by the way, that should be understood in the following way, which is not literal, no problem. So the example he brings there is in corporal punishment, where it says 40 stripes, and the sages said actually it means 39. Why should it say
40? Ein tachas ein would be another example.
An eye for an eye, which the sages tell us does not mean literally eye for an eye, but it means monetary compensation.
Lifnei iver lo site michshol.
Another example. Before the blind, don't place a stumbling block. Deuteronomy 19, whatever. So there, it doesn't mean don't trip up a blind person. That's type of obvious that you cannot do that. You don't really need to tell. I can't trip up anyone. So
it's possible that if you literally tripped somebody, you would not transgress the prohibition of lifnei iver lo site michshol.
There's a debate about that. There is a debate.
It's possible.
But you're right. No, it is possible. So what actually is understood by the Gemara, Talmud and Avodah Zorah understands it, meaning don't cause someone else to do a sin. Someone blinded by their desires or by their ignorance, and I cause them to stumble by saying, here, try this. It's kosher, etc. Prohibited. Yeah. So that's, yeah. There's many cases where the Masoret, our tradition, oral tradition, tells us no. This is how it's understood, not literal. So that's Rav Sajagon's view, and that's about the text itself.
So can I ask you, I wanted to bring up a couple of things.
Yeah.
So the Rambam, now I first saw this in the Ramban, in his Parish on the Torah, the Ramban's commentary on the Torah, where he took issue with this. But the Rambam says that in Vayera, when we find out they're angels afterwards, when three angels visit Avraham to tell him that he and Sarah are going to have Yitzchak, the Rambam says that's a nevuah.
It was a prophetic vision.
It's a prophetic vision.
Had you or I been there, we wouldn't have seen anything.
We would not have seen it. Now, and one of the reasons he feels compelled to say that is because there are angels in this nevuah, and you cannot see angels. A human being cannot see angels. The only way that a human being sees angels is in a vision or a dream. Now, and the Rambam says something similar with Bilaam. It may not be his only reason for saying it with Bilaam, but he says that the whole episode with Bilaam and his donkey, and then eventually confronting the angel when it's revealed to him there's an angel there, he says that's also a nevuah. That these are both prophecies, and it's again it seems like. One of, in other words, this would be in keeping with Rav Sadyagon's principles. In other words, if there's something that's being said that cannot be,
doesn't make sense,
then you have to look for another explanation. I mean, in this case, to say it's a nevuah, there are elements already there that help you with that, because it starts off by saying Hashem appears to Avram. It doesn't say what he said. It doesn't say
part of the reason that.
Right, and this would be how, right. So there are are, you know, elements within the Torah that help to support this. But one of the reasons that he says this, and this is one of the things that the Ramban disagrees with, and the Ramban has all sorts of questions. Are you telling me that every time, are you saying that the people in Sodom are Nevi'im because they see the Malachim? Are you saying that
I agree, yeah. But I don't think that Nachmanides is disagreeing because he's always being literal.
No, I agree. No, he's not about the literal.
He himself is okay with metaphor, allegory, etc. He's that I don't think that the text bears out. First of all, he says if an angel appears in a physical form, then anyone can see the angel. So there's nothing forcing you to go away from the default position.
Would you agree that the Rambam, because he insists on that, so he is forced to look for another option, which he finds. I'm not saying, in other words, he looks for another option to help explain the text because there's something about this that's not possible, but it may not be possible because of seichel. In other words, this would not be a problem. Obviously, it's not being told to us to read it this way. It's not a contradiction in verses, but would you agree that it fits in that
it may category? Be. Yeah, but I don't know. Again, I don't know if it indicates any type of major argument between Maimonides literalism.
Not about this. The reason I'm asking you is because I once brought this up to Akiva to Rabbi Tatz. We were just sort of schmoozing, and I presented the following to him, which he immediately, you know, sort of swatted down. But I suggested to him that the very same elements are present at the Akedah. In other words, you at one point in the binding of Yitzchak, an angel speaks to Avraham in the midst of it.
Does not say the angel appeared to him.
It
in the other two cases, it says angels appeared to him.
But he speaks to him.
Different thing. Angel speaks to you. Everyone agrees is prophetic. Here it's the other two cases are different.
I just want you to be on record. First of all, I just want to state the case.
The other two cases by Yaira,
I want to state
when they appear to Avraham, it says they appeared to him. He sees them. In the case of Bilam, he sees an angel. The donkey sees an angel. In this case, it does not say that Abraham sees an angel. So it says the angel.
You're saying that seeing and hearing are so qualitatively different, according to the Rambam. For some reason, an entirely spiritual being is not subject to the sense of seeing, but an entirely spiritual being is subject to the sense of hearing. That's what you're saying.
Well,
senses are senses.
Communicate okay. By it doesn't, because again, hearing and communication.
Hearing is synonymous. Oh, now you're okay, fine.
But it maybe we're looking at hearing not as a literal. But
you notice your knee-jerk reaction here. He had the same one, and I acknowledge it, and that's why you tell Torah over to friends, because they are your mentors and they help you stay. But just to state the case, clearly the Rambam doesn't say this by the Akedah, so he doesn't hold like him. But just to state the case, you have Avraham in a state of nevuah. When Hashem is telling him what he wants him to do, then you have a kind of continuing Vayashkem Avram Baboker, etc., which is I'm paralleling it. If I would set
I would set the text.
You don't like it, but
you're taking it too far.
Taking it too far. The parallelism is you have the introduction where you
not
have
an introduction. Nevuah. It's a command.
You have
God you gives nevuah. Him a command.
You have Hashem talking to him and telling him what he wants to do. Then you have the parallel, which is the continuity of the scenario. Then you have a malach appearing in it.
You're missing, missing crucial components in the text.
I hear your
argument listen. Listen. In the text in Vayera, there is no content of what God said to him. There is no content of God saying something to him. All it says is, wait, God appears to him.
Yeah.
That gives an introduction, which Maimonides understands as being a general introduction to the whole thing being in prophetic vision.
Right.
In the case of a command, God gives someone a command. They then, the next day, it says Abraham gets up in the morning and does this and this. There is no reason whatsoever to assume that that is done in prophetic vision. That's like, that's why the Rambam
doesn't say
it. I'll
tell you the thing that's the biggest clue to me.
It's completely right. Listen.
The biggest clue is the Malach appearing in the middle.
It doesn't appear. It doesn't say he appears. It's just another command. And you are conflating the two.
I get it that both of you, as
wise,
are having a knee-jerk reaction to it. I get
not
that.
It's not a knee-jerk reaction.
I understand
reaction.
That if this is analyze, scary territory. It's
if
scary
you analyze
territory.
The text, if you analyze the text,
you will find subtleties different. That you have to explain away,
completely
like
different.
Your explanation for
it's
the fact that somehow hearing is different than seeing.
You're not listening. It's not a subtlety. In one case, there's a verse that says God appears to him. It doesn't say God spoke to him. It says God appears to him, setting the stage for a prophetic vision.
Yeah.
In the other case, it does not say that. It says God gave him a command, and then we have a transition. Abraham carries out the command, and he carries out the command
with an angel in the middle.
Wait. While he's carrying out the command, which there is no reason to say was prophetic,
I wouldn't.
An angel gives him another command, and then
stops him from doing it. You know, according to
gives him another command.
Again,
it's very, very different. I'm sorry.
I accept that, and I accept that for the second time so far, buttons have been pushed, which is fine. And this is an important part of how we have conversations. I'm glad other people have witnessed it. All right, so now.
I did not mute you, even though I have the host controls. So keep that in mind.
Possibility. So now, all right. So
we have
something like Hashem took us out on Kanfei Nesharim. It says in Parshas Mishpatim.
Yes.
Hashem himself says, I took you out.
Egyptian vultures.
Possibly griffin vultures.
Yes.
So that's one where, I mean, maybe somewhere somebody literally said we were not taken out, but I don't think there's anybody who thinks, when you're looking at the Torah, when you're reading that, I don't think there's anybody who even pauses when they read that and go, wait a second,
right.
Were we riding on the wings of eagles or griffins?
Well, who knows? There is a book out there, which is a lot of people read. There are a couple of versions. Little Medrash says, the Medrash says, in which a lot of very strange Midrashim are offered to the public without any explanation whatsoever.
Yeah.
In which kids and adults take them very literally. And I think that's one purpose that I have in this, that at least that's in my mind in this particular episode, maybe follow-ups, is to fight against that.
To remove the little Medrash says from all bookshelves, if possible.
I don't want to get sued here, but yeah. But, you know, even halachically, even in halachic legal areas, there are times we don't take things literally. That's the argument. There's a wonderful argument. It says we are told that if someone breaks into a house, this is in Shemot Exodus 22, someone breaks into a house, so the house owner is allowed to kill the intruder, right? Like in Texas. So he can kill the intruder, and the Talmud gives it says, here's the language of the Torah. It says, if the sun shines on him, damim lo, then he has blood. In other words, says, if the person breaks into a house and the house owner kills him, ein lo damim, there's no blood, meaning it's blood was not spilled. He is exempt. The house owner, the homeowner, is exempt, not a murder charge. I think in America they call that the castle doctrine. Your home is your castle. Okay. And then it says, if the sun shone.
In your case, it's true. You have a gigantic house.
Immense. It's a mansion. It's like
it's a mansion. Just the porch.
People sometimes stop here thinking it's the town hall. That's, you know, and I say, I'm sorry, I can't accept your taxes. So it's like this. Im zarcha alav ha-shemesh, if the sun shone, damim yesh lo, damim lo, then he has got blood. It's a strange expression. So here's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, when it says if the sun shone on this house invader, what's the term?
The intruder.
The intruder, thank you, yes.
Yeah.
If the sun shone on the intruder means... if it was as clear as daylight, actually, I just used a metaphor in English, clear as daylight.
You did.
If it is clear as daylight that he is not a danger to you, you're not allowed to kill him. So the case, the Gemara is a strange case. The Gemara says a father breaks into his son's house. So the son, it's clear as daylight, the father's not there to kill the son. I don't know why he's breaking in, mate. Surprise party. I have no idea, right? But he's not allowed to kill him because it's clear as daylight. You know, I don't know. Mahatma Gandhi intrudes into your house. You know, he's emaciated. He has no weapons on him. He's wearing a loincloth. He's a man of peace. He's not going to kill. Sun shines. Don't kill him. So we're understanding the Talmud, and this is how the Rambam, by the way, rules this way. He rules that sun shines on you. That means clear as daylight that he's not a threat. So...
even the phrase dumbing is a poetic phrase.
Blood.
He has blood. One person has blood, the other person doesn't have blood. Even poetic phrase. That's like we understand that means his life has value or you are considered to have spilled blood if you did it. You're not considered to have spilled blood if
100%.
Yeah, so even that is a kind of so
the Ravid, however, when the Rambam rules that way, Rambam explicitly says the whole law of this intruder, it doesn't matter if it's day or night. If he breaks in the middle of the day, you can still shoot him.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant day or night. He says that phrase, if the sun shines, is completely metaphorical. It means if it's clear as day, the Ravid, Avram ben David of Posquares, who often, not always, argues with the Rambam and has comments on him. Remember once hearing in the name of, I think it was the Sfasemes, one of the Rebbes of Ger, someone asked him, how can you prove God's existence? And the Ger Rebbe said, the Rambam rules that God exists. The Ravid doesn't argue. to great proof. Anyway. But the Ravid says, he says, no, that is wrong. He says, I'm going to write, Eini nimna milichtovet dati. I'm not going to stop writing my opinion here. It appears to me, even though the sages understood Zarcha HaShemesh, the sun shining, as being a mashal, im barur lecha keshemesh, if it's as clear as you, as daylight, he says, afal pikein, nevertheless, Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. I don't think you can extract the verse from its simple reading. And if it's during the day, you're not allowed to kill him. You're only allowed to kill him at night. So, wow. The Talmud says clearly, and no one disagrees in the Gemara, the Rambam says, paskins that way, rules that way, that day or night, it's irrelevant. This is purely a metaphor. The Ravid says, sorry. You can't take the text completely out of its simple meaning, and you're only allowed to kill the intruder if it's at night. Not disclaimer here. We're not giving legal advice. We're giving you the theoretical Torah.
Who's planning on killing by an intruder,
right, or someone who gets arrested,
I should research it well before.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Make your own decision. But that's what the Ravid says. And there's another case where the Ravid says a similar thing. The Rambam here when he talks about the times of the Messiah, times of the Mashiach, he says that which it says in the Torah that the lion shall lie down with the lamb and the jackal with the with the with the young goat
in Novi, in Novi.
So the Rambam says that that is a it's a metaphor. It means that there'll be peace between the Jews and the anti-Semite. Anti-Semites will no longer attack us, and etc. He says all these matters of the days of the Mashiach, all these statements about the animal kingdom and the sharks becoming vegans and so on, that's not explicit, but all that, he says, the Rambam says, a metaphor for peace amongst people and so on.
So I want to ask you
Just mention what
go
the Ravid says
ahead.
There.
Yeah.
The Ravid says, Halo katuv batorah. It says in the Torah, Vihishbati chayara amin haaretz. I will eradicate or cease evil animals from the land. So the Ravid's claim here is all of those statements that the Rambam interprets metaphorically, allegorically, are all in prophets and writings. The Ravid's problem here is that Batorah katuv, in the Torah, in the text of the five books of Moses, it says that. He says that you can't easily say as a metaphor.
But what would he do with Kanfei Neshorim?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't
what
know
would
the
he do
comments
with
the Ravid on that.
What would he do with Hashem Ish Milchama?
Excellent question. These are great questions. The Ravid, like there's the most famous Ravid in this matter, and this may be an answer, is the Rambam in the third chapter of Laws of Tshuva, where the Rambam is enumerating the different types of heretics and other assorted lowlifes, etc. So he says, one example is a person who believes that God is corporeal. God has a body. It's a heretic. He's a heretic. So the Ravid there says, he says the following. I'm going to quote it because it's fascinating. Lama kara lazem min. Why did he call this person a heretic? Halo kama, kama v'chama gedolim v'tovim mimenu. A number of great and good people from amongst us.
Greater than him.
No, not greater than him.
Mimenu, you're not reading it that way?
Rav Moshe Shapiro.
Nice. Okay, good.
Said that mimenu does not mean from him, greater than him. It means from amongst us.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's very important.
That in Davni, where is it? In Mariv, we say, Ugi Allah, Hashem
Chazak
redeemed
mimenu.
The Jews, Miyad yeah. Chazak mimenu from a...
Yeah.
Amongst no. the, I don't know. But okay, I don't know if that's exactly the
okay,
same.
Okay, nice. Okay, good.
But he says, nice. Okay, he says, Halchu Bazua Machshava, they followed this view that God yeah. is corporeal. But yeah. he says, why? Lefima Shera'u B'mikra, because what they saw in the text.
Right, but then go on, he says.
V'yoter, and even worse, or more, Mima Shera'u B'divrei Ha'agadot, things they saw in Agadah Midrashim.
In Midrash.
Hamashabshois es hadayas, that confuse the mind.
Right. So he sounds like he agrees
okay, that yeah. Midrash is confusing. He agrees that you shouldn't be taking these verses literally.
And they're wrong.
He just
agrees they're wrong.
Exactly. Mashabshois es hadayas, they're wrong. But he says you can't call a person a heretic because the person is a simple Jew. And the Jew has opened up the Chumash, or the Midrash says, or one of those horrific parsha sheets that are given out in shuls. I don't get me started. But with stories that are just incomprehensible.
Moshe Rabbeinu is 20 feet tall.
But worse than that, the story about righteous
tall.
People that are clearly incorrect. Like they'll tell a story about a city that didn't exist at the time that the story happened, right? They'll tell about some unbelievable the levels of inaccuracy and just a complete disregard for factual content is unbelievable. But leaving that aside, he says people look at these and they get confused and are mistaken. So we see even the Ravid agrees that it is confusing and you can't take these things literally. His argument is that he sees that a person who's not intentionally rebelling against the Torah, he's just a, what we call in Yiddish, a poshita yid, a simple Jew. Such a person cannot be accused of heresy, as Maimonides. Now, there's a famous...
What about a Nebuchadnezzar?
That's that Reb Chaim Brisker is quoted by Reb Elchanan Wasserman as explaining the Rambam. And he says, what's the Rambam's view? The Rambam's view is Nebuch HaApikoros is Oichid and Apikoros. That means a pitiful, woeful heretic, still heretic, because he still has the wrong belief. Why he got there, not concern me. Does he have the right belief or the wrong belief? He's got the wrong belief. But here you have to modify that. Because and Rabbi Chanan does modify that, because we know that even the Rambam himself is willing to be much more generous and less condemning about certain heretics if they were brought up that way. Famously, in Laws of Mamrim, where he talks about rebellion against the authority of the Torah, where he talks about the Karaites who didn't believe in the oral tradition. So he says that my description of them as heretics is only about the first generation and the teachers, but the children and the students who have been brought up for generations as Karaites, believing this is it, they are Tinoika Shenishbu, children who have been captured by, like children captured by pagans. And I've got to say, every time I use the phrase Tinok Shenishba, I can't help thinking about the actual
hostages.
Yeah. It disturbs me every time. I think there's been a day in the past year and a half I have not thought about the Bibas kids. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's upsetting.
One more thing.
To say the least. But anyway, he says it's like a child captured. So you see, even the Rambam ascribes some level of excuse to someone like that. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, and I think this is how I understood it, is understanding a little bit as if we can trace the source of the mistake to something outside this guy, i.e. his teachers, his parents, his grandparents, his whole environment, then he is indeed an anus. It's not his fault. He's not a heretic.
It's still incorrect,
but he's just not a heretic.
He, in other words, if he wrote it in a book, it would be considered heresy.
But he personally, you don't look
at it. It's not a heretic.
However, right, what if the source of the mistake comes from within? So the Rambam himself, in Guide for the Perplexed, addresses the Ravid's question. He doesn't directly address the Ravid. In Guide for the Perplexed, in the Moron Avuchim, the Rambam says, look, he says, if you ask a person who says, look, it says in the Torah, hand of God, so therefore he must have a hand. He says, ask him the following question. The Torah says, umaltem es orlas levavchem. You shall circumcise the foreskin of your heart. Hand him a knife. I'm paraphrasing the Rambam, original Arabic. Hand him a knife and say, go ahead. The Torah says, right? The guy will there say, oh, no, that's clearly a metaphor. He says, what's the difference? Because one hurts and one doesn't. So obviously the distortion comes from within him, because he's willing to accept metaphor in one place, not in another. But here I have a bit of a problem, because the Ravid, in the case of Baba Machteret, the intruder, he's insisting on you must understand this. Because and the other case is in the times of the Mashiach. Now, when it comes to the intruder, I have a little bit of a answer. Maybe. Because there it is, the Torah is not.
You're going to kill a guy.
It's not just narrative. Exactly. Right. It's giving me instructions.
You're going to kill somebody.
So when the Torah is giving me instructions, there I can't take it as a metaphor. The rabbi was saying, sorry, the Torah is giving me instructions. That's not a metaphor. Right? If it's giving me. So and a person's life is at stake, yes. Also true. I forgot the human side of it. And thank you for mentioning that. But
that happens often. Yes. Go ahead.
Right,
yes.
No. Right. So that is that. On the other hand, but how does it work? But when it comes to the case of the days of the Mashiach, when the Rambam interprets the animal world's, you know, peaceful, harmonious nature is not referring to the animals themselves, it's a metaphor. And the Ravid says, yeah, but what about the Torah? The Torah says, Hishbati Chayara Amin Haaretz, I will cease all evil animals from the land. There he's not willing to accept that. Now, that's not an instruction. That's a prediction.
Right.
And yet he's still not willing to accept it. Yet he doesn't hold its heresy. I'm not exactly sure how to deal with the...
Let me ask you a scenario.
Yes.
So...
God breaks into...
So according to, you know, that... the criteria set down by Rasajagon.
Yes.
So, and it sounds like we've been talking about some examples about this, but if something... triggers a response in your seichel. In other words, your seichel just goes, right. So I remember reading an article written by Arya Kaplan, but I don't remember where it was, where he talked about at one point trying to figure out the age of people, you know, up until Avraham. And he was wondering, maybe these are months, maybe months were being spoken of as years at the time. And, you know, and so instead of somebody being 960, they'd really be 80. And let's say something like that. But then he said the problem was they're given birth then at like age 4. That didn't work. But he was you know, trying. He was trying to see if the ages, he didn't come up with anything, but he felt comfortable experimenting, exploring, trying to come up with what might be a non-literal explanation for the years. And that seems to be in keeping, you know, that doesn't seem to be outside of what a pious Jew might do if you were
who you ask. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah,
but controversy about the age of the universe.
And also, by the way, poetry is a genre. There are times when poetry is happening and we realize it. If steam is coming out of Hashem's nose,
Chalon af. Yeah.
Right. So none of us need to be told that is poetry. Right. It's just like there's certain things that are happening that they, and I'm suggesting to you the same thing with Kanfei Nesharim. When people saw Kanfei Nesharim, that Hashem took us out on Kanfei Nesharim, the average person, no matter what their background, no matter what family they were raised in, did not think that we were literally on the wings of griffin vultures.
Right. Although I'll tell you, when the state of Israel brought thousands of Yemenite Jews to Israel in the early days of the state, and of course we know the tragedy that occurred later, in which they forcibly assimilated many of them, were terrible, taking children, but I'm not going to go into that.
Yes. But
when they brought them on planes, a lot of these people had never seen planes before.
Yes.
And they assumed
that was Kanfei Nesharim.
This was Kanfei Nesharim, the wings of eagles. And I believe that the Jewish agency may have even called the operation Operation Wings of Eagles. I don't remember. That's a possibility.
Right. And I'm open to
that. I don't know. Did they think that way?
Right. There are people who want to say that the descriptions of the locust in Yoel, in Sefer Yoel, are surprisingly similar to fighter jets, you know, going across the sky with they're coming out the back or
and
things.
Timrot Ashan, you ever heard of that one? Timrot Ashan,
a nuclear
mushroom, a nuclear clouds or
a nuclear
palm, sorry, date
explosion.
Palms. Tamar is a date palm, the shape of the
But that's you know, I'm open to those kind of possibilities. I'm open to anything. I'm not limiting it. I'm just saying there's a reaction to certain kinds of phrases that you don't even need instruction. It was your own reaction. The reason I'm bringing up Kanfei Nesharim is because I believe that most people would say the minute they saw it, they had no doubt that this was poetry.
Correct.
In other words, it was their own reaction. They didn't need to be instructed by their Rebbe and Cheder that this is not literal. It was their own reaction that because there's certain times like that where you just realize that this is poetry.
Right.
So the question is this. The Gan Eden.
Garden of Eden, yes.
Right. So in Gan Eden, there is a walking, talking snake.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Are those symbols, are they meant to direct us to the notion that this is a parable or that this is a poetic kind of story?
Yeah, we're heading into territory like the Nachmanides, in his very opening paragraph in his commentary on Bereishis, on Genesis. he says that the deeds of creation cannot be known from the simple reading of the verses unless you have a tradition, person to person, back to Moses at Sinai. And those who have that tradition are obligated to hide it, to conceal it. So, which is not very helpful to us. So that's number one. I don't know where to go with that, because the Rambam in his Guide for the Perplexed does see these things as somehow metaphorical and allegories. And I know that one of, in the famous controversy about the Rambam that took place primarily in Provence after he passed away, but after the Guide was translated from Arabic into Hebrew and became well known. So Chachmei Montpellier, beautiful city, by the way, right? Chachmei Montpellier, I went there with Legacy Kosher Tours last summer. It was unbelievable, right? So Montpellier, right? That was a plug, by the way. So the sages there, one of their objections to, they had something like 29 or 30 objections to the Rambam. But one of them was they felt he was playing fast and loose with allegorizing the Torah. And they were very upset at him doing that. They felt he went too far. You see that the Ravid, who, would, by the way, was from Provence, right, felt the same way. He says, how do you take the Chumash, a verse in the Torah, daylight, and say it doesn't mean daylight?
So, but Chazal did it in that case.
I know. And he says, but I'm not going to refrain is, from you, presenting my view.
Here is the problem. When you tell somebody something is poetry or something is allegory, their concern is that because it's poetry or allegory, at this point, I have to sort of figure it out. There's an unfinished something, and I'm now having to figure out the rest of it.
But you're not on your own here. You're not on your own. That's what the Rambam, Maimonides actually says in
Guide. It sounds like you're on your own. That's what they feel. Oh, every guy is going to be that way. On his own, and he's going to decide what that means. That's but it's what not so. Think's going to happen.
Like the Rambam says to this person who the Ravid's describing, who says, well, I don't know, it says it in the Torah. The Rambam says, well, hello, you're not on your own. First of all, we have the sages. We have a long tradition of the sages who are telling us things. We also have the Targum Onkelos, the Aramaic translation, who
does this a lot.
Who does this a lot. And
especially
and
anything also, that has to do with Hashem's corporeality.
He also detours and directs us away from corporealism. And,
you're
not alone. He says, if you don't know, go to someone who knows more than you. Who has it.
That is the key. That is the key. Having a Rebbe, having friends that you
Agreed.
Can talk it over with.
Agreed.
That have short
having a podcast,
on things like the Akedah.
Having
things
a podcast
like that
will
where
clarify
you just,
things.
Yeah, where you could just bring up your thing and in the confidence that your friends will listen to you fully and then patiently respond to you, like with the Akedah. Possibility,
without
which
muting
you,
you
which
you
demonstrated,
so.
Did you demonstrated how you listened carefully and then only responded in a way that encouraged me to ask more questions, which has always been at the very key of our relationship.
I'm not sure if that was intentional, but okay. I think we're gonna have to leave this for a second part. There's another part two that we owe people
where we actually get to Medrash.
We owe a part two on the music one where we're going to interview. Hopefully a musician, composer, producer, multi-talented Jewish music aficionado, hopefully if he agrees. After I've said all this, he may disagree. But in any case, that we hope to do. And we also owe a second part of this particular discussion, because we've been focused completely, almost completely, on the written Torah, which itself is a huge discussion. Yeah. And I would like to move... the next one to the Midrash and Agadata. There's a lot of fascinating insights in the Rishonim and Achronim to how to deal with those. I think well worth looking into. And also, God willing, I'm hoping by next week we'll have my son Pini will be able to give us some Israel insights You know,
you have to listen to it right away, though, because it could be outdated
in 10 minutes.
We have to make sure.
Right.
And again, the promise of secrets. He's going to reveal secrets. Didn't you say that?
I want to get him in trouble with his commanding officer.
All right, whatever. A person can try.
Yeah. Okay.
We can always get your Mossad friend in.
He passed away a while ago. But okay.
He says he passed away, but did he pass away? You can't tell with Mossad agents. That's the easiest thing in the world for them to fake their deaths.
You're sounding Hasidic now. Okay. Yeah, he did pass away, yes. All right. Okay, good to see you as usual. Good to speak to you. All who are listening, please tell your friends to listen. Spread the word. This is the podcast to listen to. And
it's not a podcast.
No, it's not. It's the podcast to listen to, despite what we said. But it is
music.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Be well. Thank you, Mordecai.